cliffcentral.com.
Mark Oppenheimer is with the Bridge Group of Advocates. He is regularly called in on matters of free speech when it comes to these things being litigated. And he's also been on the Renegade Report here on cliffcentral.com as a guest before. So I'm thrilled to have him on this morning to talk to us about a number of things. Among those, freedom of speech, where the major threats to freedom of speech seem to be coming from these days, how the landscape of politics affects these areas of free speech, because clearly that's where we end up having to go to court about them, and his own personal feelings on things like Donald Trump, whether there's a Muslim ban or not, the separation of powers between the executive, the judiciary, and the legislature here in South Africa and in America, and how often those get blurred. Whether it works for us or against us is often the ancillary argument to that. Mark, it's a pleasure to see you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you've really been involved in this stuff on a very big scale, pretty much most of your professional career. It's something that you've become a specialist in.
Yeah, it's something I feel very passionate about. You know, free speech is one of those fundamental rights. If you don't have free speech, everything else falls away. It's very hard to protect your other freedoms and your access to liberties if you can't speak freely.
Well, you'll have no argument from me on that front. I think we're of a like mind in that respect. But I'm curious, before we get stuck into the ideas and the issues, which I know you and I are much more passionate about than the backstory. There must be a backstory here. I mean, you can't just have grown up being a free speech advocate. How does that start?
I suppose I've always been an unusual chap. You know, I have sort of long hair and a beard.
Yeah, you don't look like a lawyer. And I would imagine in court, it can sometimes be, well, certainly for older judges, disconcerting to see a lawyer, a male lawyer, come in with like Samson's hair and the suit and all the rest of it on. But it's a bit of a contradiction.
Well, funny enough, with our robes, which come from the 1600s, I feel like my getup looks rather congruous. Yeah. Often I think I look a little bit like Jan van Riebeck just stepped off a boat, you know, sort of this, you know, Cape Dutch kind of looking thing.
You look like an eccentric intellectual. You got the, you know, the horn-rimmed glasses, the long hair. And you've got a bit of a beard, which kind of, it sort of makes you look like you're one of those funny people who reads more than they say.
Yes, I like to try and strike the right balance. I like speaking as much as I can too, which is probably also why I think free speech matters so much. And that growing up as a bit of an eccentric person, I think it's important to express different ideas, partly so you can reconsider your own, that you can hear the other side, that you can say something a bit outrageous, and the other person can think about it and fight back. You know, so many of my kind of conversations when I was growing up were on a dinner table where different views were expressed. There's philosophers and lawyers in my family. And so whenever we would have, you know, a get-together, we would have this kind of ongoing discussion and fight, and that it was a free-for-all for fun. That debate was encouraged. You know, trying on different ideas like hats was seen as a virtuous thing, as opposed to something that defines your identity. And that if you, you know, if you hold this view now, then, you know, you've done something which is unlovable. You know, some people sort of feel like they're tied to the ideas in a very permanent way. Whereas at least in my family, it was seen as something that you could test out, that you could strengthen your ideas and change your mind, and it was all acceptable.
That is an interesting point of view. Some people are very threatened by that. Some people are very threatened by the fact that you read a lot of books so that you can try on ideas like hats, because they never got that opportunity, and they'll say, oh, well, you're privileged. Or worse, they'll say, it's better to have one book that gives you all the rules of life, and that if you just follow that one book, things are much simpler.
Yes.
If you don't, you're just the devil.
Sure. I mean, this is an interesting thing that people sort of want one source of guidance. You know, I think even religious people, if I think about the culture in Orthodox Judaism, is very interesting, because for them it's multiple texts, you know, this idea of commentary, of working out what does this text mean, of continuing debate.
The Talmud is all about debates, and sometimes from children to adults, to people who are completely uninformed about the religion, and people who are extraordinarily scholarly about the religion,
yes,
all having open discussion. In fact, Judaism among the monotheisms is unique in that it was early on in its history very introspective and willing to be tested, willing to have its ideas broken on the wheel if necessary?
Well, one of the studying techniques is people study in pairs to try and disprove the text.
Mm-hmm.
So you're encouraging the sense of, let's see if we can find errors. Let's see if we can try and prove this thing wrong.
That's almost a scientific method.
Exactly. Yeah.
Of course, it isn't science because there's a lot of mythology in there, but you've got to give credit to the method.
Yes, and I think that's why you have this interesting influx of atheist Jews, that they've taken something excellent out of the methodology, as you say, the sense of caring about evidence, caring about reason, caring about arguments, and then applying it to the empirical world as opposed to the spiritual world.
Well, that's why disproportionately, I suppose, certainly this is an opinion of mine, but I think the statistics will bear it out, that disproportionately high numbers of secular Jews are also the leaders in any intellectual movement in any country where they are present and have made contributions that outweigh their numbers in vast disproportion.
Yeah, it is quite a phenomenal thing. I think something like a third of Nobel Prize winners are of Jewish descent. If you think about Jews on the Constitutional Court, that's considering that you've only got 14 million Jews. They're more Jains than there are Jews in the world.
Right. Now, I will get into trouble with probably Jews for saying this, but I would say that is, if there ever is mythological proof in the real world of a chosen people, then this is it. I would say that they are, the reason they punch so far above their weight is though because of this rigorous testing of ideas from an early age and the fact that you are required to think things through and prove your point of view, whether it's about religion or science or humor for that
sure.
matter.
And I think saying no to an orthodoxy makes a big difference as well. You know, that if the idea is that there's one person who knows the truth, you know, whether it's the state or your teacher or your priest, if you can reject that notion and see that there are many other ways that you can discover what's true in the world, and that a lot of it is harbored in sort of a range of different people, that you can engage with them, you can talk to them, you can get recommended books by them, you then really uncover what's going on in the world as opposed to sort of absorbing a state orthodoxy, you know, which you
so
think about.
How did we even get onto this? Are you a practicing, or were you at some point a practicing Jew?
I always tell people that I'm Jewish.
Yeah, I know the old joke, but in your case, is it that you're proud of your connection to and your cultural inheritance, but you're not necessarily a religious Jew?
Yeah, that's not a bad way of putting it. I've spent a lot of time with very Orthodox Jews, and I think almost more as an anthropologist in a sense. Because some of it is utterly bizarre. It's very entertaining. It's very interesting. There's a lot of value there. But it is nonetheless really strange. And I think part of what I'm fascinated with in Orthodox Judaism is the way they understand law. So the way that they interpret law is fascinating. And so someone who's interested in legal rules and systems, I have an interest in it from that perspective.
How is it fascinating as opposed to the way that a Muslim or a Christian or an atheist might respond to law?
I'll give you a good example. So most people are aware that Jews don't drive on the Sabbath.
Mm.
Okay. So the Torah obviously has no rule that says don't drive on the Sabbath. So how do they get the rule? So there's a line that says don't work on the Sabbath.
Mm-hmm.
The question was, okay, well, what constitutes work? They said, well, one of the things that was work was building a tabernacle. I said, what does it mean to build a tabernacle? They identified 36 different things, one of which was building a fire. I said, but what is a fire? And they said, well, there's chemical fires and there's electrical fires. I said, all right, well, you've got a combustion engine in a car. That's a form of chemical fire. Therefore, no driving on the Sabbath. So the way that you get to the rule is in this very interesting way of trying to extrapolate the meaning of words throughout in a way that expands the rule dramatically. So you have tens of thousands of rules about what you can and can't do on the Sabbath.
And then you have those inventions that are mechanical that allow you to get away with breaking the rule but not really breaking the rule. The letter of the law is observed,
yes.
But actually you've cheated God.
Well, this is the other fascinating thing about it. So there's, in that form of Religulus, they have this Center for Halakha and Science. And one of the machines they have is, so you can't dial a phone on the Sabbath.
Uh-huh.
So what it does is it simultaneously dials all numbers and then removes numbers. till it gets the number that you want. So you find this ingenious way of getting to the outcome that you want. And I think that's also why Jews make great lawyers, you know?
No, I see that now. That's actually a very good point. And this is how history can sometimes be extremely beneficial. Because if people have been finding ways not to break the laws of God, that are essentially, these are the things that lawyers do every day. They try to find ways not to break the law for their clients. while trying essentially to get their clients off the hook or to get what their clients need and deserve.
Yes.
It's a fascinating way of seeing laws. You're not emotionally attached to them, but if you can find a way of understanding them and making other people understand them from your point of view, you win.
Very much so. I think that's a lot of what we have to do as lawyers is trying to understand legal language, interpret it, translate it, bend it within reason.
And what Oppenheimers are you from? Are you from the Oppenheimers, the South African Oppenheimers?
I always say that when asked, and it's something I get asked all the time, is, are you related to the Oppenheimers? I say, no, they're related to me.
No, but don't be facetious with me. I mean, people want to know your context.
So we all come from the same little town in Germany called Oppenheim.
Okay.
And interesting enough, everyone that bore the name Oppenheimer, were all Jews. They were invited into the town by the king in the 1200s.
Which is a rare thing for Jews to be invited in by a European monarch. Usually they were doing the opposite.
Yes. Yeah. 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 They were invited in to stir up commerce. And so I went to visit Oppenheim a while ago, and they had the 1,000-year anniversary of celebrating the right to have a marketplace when I was there.
Hmm.
So it's a very ancient town. It was conquered by Napoleon at some point, so it was part of France. So then my grandparents were German and lived in Germany up until 1933 when they were forced to flee.
Hmm.
And their parents came out in 1939 on one of the last boats away from Nazi Germany.
They just made it out.
Very much so, yeah.
Oh, okay, so the Sir Ernest and Harry Oppenheimer, and they must be cousins of, but you're not closely related. In other words, you're not South African related.
Not enough to get into the money.
No, sure, but you know what people will assume all kinds of things when they see a surname.
Yes,
and you must have had to put up with that for a while too, in terms of people assuming that you come from huge piles of money, or that you are just a younger scion of the same family. And therefore, ultra-capitalist mining aristocracy, effectively.
Yeah, it's one of those things that's played differently over time. So I think,
has it ever been of any advantage?
Yeah. So I think when I was younger, you know, there's generally a sort of, maybe Oppenheimers have some sort of royal name in South African history. So, you know, people would be a bit differential. I don't really like when people are differential to me, though. I find that odd.
This celebration you went to attend the opening of the market, I mean, that's 1,000 years ago. What's amazing about that is that essentially this capitalism was being celebrated.
Yes.
And you don't find people celebrating capitalism these days. It's in vogue to celebrate socialism and Marxism. You have people, smart people, who ought to know better, because there are countless examples of how socialism has failed in its implementation. Smart people calling themselves Marxists and wearing it as a badge of honor. What do you make of that as someone who I assume is likelier to celebrate his own history of capitalism in his family?
So I think it's utterly outrageous that someone can celebrate that kind of ideology when it's led to so much death and suffering.
Millions and millions of people. I only discovered recently for the first time the story of the Ukrainian starvation of the 1920s, where millions of peasant farmers were chased off of their land in a social engineering experiment by extreme implementers of Lenin's Marxism, communism. And 6 million people had to be told not to eat their own children.
And the idea that we can venerate this ideology...
Sorry,
we 6
million
put
people
it to bed.
Died. Many millions more were told not to eat their children. Sorry,
yes,
you know, for the sake of being right.
I mean, it's not like we only have to look into history. I mean, you can look at Venezuela now.
Hmm.
You know, you can see what happens when the state tries to control the market. You know, you end up with empty shelves.
Utopia is only ever one bullet away, remember? That's what they say about that kind of extreme leftism. Now, what is your... Do you have a political bent, or do you approach everything objectively and go, well, let me figure it out?
So I think it's important to care about evidence and to always open your mind up to what's really going on. If you're a true ideologue, then you don't care about those things. You know, you'll always try and bend the world to fit your will. That's very dangerous. But having said that, I think I describe myself as a sort of centrist liberal about as close as I can get. Unfortunately, you know, the problem with language is that it gets distorted by others.
Mm.
So liberal in America means something very different to what it means here. There's this.
What does it mean to you?
So I think it means you fundamentally care about freedom. you care about rights. So you think that other people matter. You can also buy into something like a separation of powers. So if you're a constitutional liberal, you think that it's important that power isn't centered in a small cabal. You know, what the Marxists want to do is have utter control from the sort of big brother type character.
Totalitarianism.
Exactly.
Yeah. And
what liberals do is we say, we think that people are corruptible, and it's important that you diffuse power, so that if one arm of the government fails, the others are there to keep it in check.
Right.
And we find that in South Africa at the moment. So I think there's been this acceptance that the courts are playing an extraordinary role in South African history at the moment.
Mm.
That because we've got deficits in the executive and the legislature, the courts are going to step up and play this dominant force to show like what the constitution requires.
Yeah, and if you think about the first few years of our post-apartheid history, the courts were, apart from their ratifying of a few constitutional objectives and state versus Makwanyane and that kind of thing, the courts were largely just doing the humdrum stuff. They really had to step up recently. You see it now, left, right, and center. The Chief Justice is considered, you know, an ally of the people in some ways that I don't think people thought much of the Chief Justice before, unless they were in the law as a career.
What's fascinating about someone like Mogoeng is, you know, he was only on the Constitutional Court for 2 years before he was appointed Chief Justice.
Mm.
There was a feeling at the time that he was going to be Zuma's lapdog.
Mm.
And ultimately, you know, he says the lines that, you know, the sword of justice will chop off the head of impunity in the Nkanda judgment.
Mm.
And he holds the president to account publicly before the nation, you know, in this very powerful way. And I remember raising my concerns about Mogoeng to Justice O'Regan. And she says, the court has a way of shaping individuals. Those institutions are bigger than those that are inside of them. And I think you find that if you're in an institution that is truly independent, that you may have been placed there by the president, but that you can't be removed by the president, that makes the big difference. That you realize, I can now be independent. I can express the views that I personally believe, you know, I think the Constitution requires me to do, as opposed to what some other, you know, political taskmaster wants you to do. And so if those institutions are kept intact, it allows you to have this check on corruption in other areas.
Mm. So this separation of powers is a big part of probably why you believe in the law and why you believe in the rule of law and why you are a lawyer by profession.
Yes, I think it would be very hard to be a lawyer in an evil state. When the laws are unjust, when there is no check on power, when the system itself is a sham. You know, you sort of look at what legal systems like were under communist Russia.
Mm.
You know, the idea was, there's a famous proclamation. Someone said, you can invent any offense you want, and I'll find a way to make someone guilty of it. You know, they could bend the rules in any way that suited the system. And if you're declared an enemy of the state, you know, excellent, we'll find some way to, you know, lock you up in the gulag. Whereas if you have, you know, due process, you have a clear set of rules that people can understand, that they can govern their behavior from beforehand. It's very hard to do that, to victimize people.
Well, this brings us elegantly to the question of the hate speech bill. And I don't want to get you into trouble because I know you're involved in this matter, you know, intimately, and that it has professional ramifications for you and obviously for the country. So I don't want to in any way jeopardize those. So if you don't want to answer, it's not because you don't believe in free speech. It's because you have a professional obligation to your clients, to the court, as an officer of the court, and for many other reasons. It's not you trying to obfuscate and find a way out of answering the question. But this hate speech bill, from what I understand, is extraordinarily problematic in a number of ways. I attended a lecture given by Rex van Schalkwyk the other day, the former judge, who said it is not only irredeemable in that it can't be fixed and cobbled and changed and polished into a proper piece of legislation, but that from the outset it ought to be scrapped because it is just completely anti the constitutional provisions of for free speech, but that it is also in the common law already many of the provisions that it seeks to enact, many of the people it wishes to protect are already protected by things like crimen injuria, and that it's superfluous, effectively. What are you allowed to say about it?
So I can speak about it in general terms. I think I think the first starting point we've got to look at is, what does the Constitution actually require? So Section 16 grants an enormous room for free speech. We have freedom of academic research, artistic creativity, the freedom of the press, the ability to express whatever ideas you want. And then what we do is we internally limit. And so we say there's three things that don't that aren't encompassed in the right to free speech.
Okay.
First is propaganda for war. Second is incitement of imminent violence.
These have real world consequences.
Yes.
This isn't about people's feelings.
Exactly. When we think about what violence means, we're talking about something very significant. We're talking about hacking people apart in Rwanda.
Or arson.
Yes, destruction of property.
Right.
We're not talking about, you know, as leftists are fond of saying, your presence is a violence, you know, or that is violent language.
Yeah.
We're talking about genuine acts of violence.
So there is no amount of political correctness being catered for here. There is none of the soft stuff. The law is very clear in terms of the Constitution, because I have got into trouble for this before. I've been corrected by other advocates who said to me, no, you don't seem to understand the limitations on free speech. So the first one is propaganda to war. That's fairly clear. I don't think I can be in under any misconception there. The other one, incitement, direct incitement to violence.
Imminent violence. So that's the other thing we need to bear in mind.
So you can't say, I promise in 20 years there will be violence.
Yes. It must be in the moment. So John Stuart Mill has this classic example. He says...
Fire in the crowded theater.
Fire in the crowded theater is a good example, because the idea is that it causes a stampede. So you yell fire, everyone gets off their seats and they trample each other, and you have death. His example is, he says, imagine you're standing in front of a factory owner's place of work, in front of an angry mob holding pitchforks, and you say to them, the factory owner is exploiting you and you need to rise up against him. There's a strong likelihood that in that moment, the people will be, you know, brought into a fervor and they'll, you know, spike the factory owner and, you know, destroy the factory. He says, if you express the identical view in the printed form, and all the factory workers are, you know, having their tea and scones and reading the paper, they're not in a position to act violently at the time. There's no imminent threat. He thinks the idea is perfectly acceptable to express. So the context matters quite a lot.
Okay.
There's a third prohibition in the Constitution, which says that advocacy of hatred, and then it lists four grounds. So race, ethnicity, gender, and religion. And that constitutes incitement to harm.
So there are two parts to this, and
yes,
both have to come into play.
It's not the mere advocacy of hatred.
So you could be a bigot. You could be an outright bigot and say something nasty about black people, white people, Islam, someone who's transgender. It does not mean that you have brought about real hate speech.
So I like to draw the distinction between hate speech and hateful speech.
Okay.
So let's have a look at...
Remember, you're talking to me now as an idiot, because I have been accused of these things before, and other people who may be listening to us may have been accused of these things before. What's the difference between hate speech and hateful speech?
So I'll give you the example. Let's say we look at Penny Sparrow, right? So Penny Sparrow has this infamous tweet, which ultimately leads to this legislation. Minister of Justice says, we've got this outbreak of racist speech on social media. We need legislation to deal with this. And the legislation is coming directly to combat people like Penny Sparrow. But her original tweet, she describes a group of black people on the beach as monkeys, and she says, the black on black skin, what a shame. And she says this very hateful thing. She compares a whole race of people to a class of animals. But there's no call for action. She never says, you know what we need to do with the monkeys on the beach, we need to shoot them, we need to exterminate them. But undoubtedly what she's saying is bigoted and hateful and racist. Okay. Then a couple of days later, you have a response from a guy called Valapi Kamala. And he says, we need to do to white people what Hitler did to the Jews. We need to rise up against them. And so there what you have is the advocacy of hatred bit on the grounds of race, but there's also this call to action. There's this call to genocide. And so the second category falls into the hate speech category, because you've got the call to action that you're inciting harm or violence.
So actually it's very difficult to comply with the requirements for actual hate speech, because you need to have a plan of action.
Yes.
In the moment. I mean, you can make it up there and then. But for it to be proven to be hate speech, it must be both. must be the advocacy. So say something hateful, but then also require an action.
Yes. And it's, so what it is that you're calling upon third parties as well. That incitement bit's important. So it's not that the words that I say harm you. It's that I'm calling on others through my words to harm you. That's an right. important distinction to bear in mind, because often people think, well, you said this thing to me and I feel wounded. I feel harmed, and they want to understand harm.
Offended.
Exactly, offended.
And harm, that word harm, what does that mean?
It's a difficult thing to grasp. So traditionally harm is understood as something like harm to your bodily integrity, to your financial well-being. Okay. There's an argument that it could encompass psychological harm. So I'll give an example, like there's a torture method where you tie someone down and you slowly drip water onto their head.
Waterboarding.
Not waterboarding where
you actually tip them over and
suffocating. So here the slow gradual drip of the water isn't going to bore into your flesh.
Yeah, it's Chinese water torture, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You'll be driven slowly mad.
Yeah.
And you might think that's a form of psychological harm, if there isn't any physical harm on you. You're obviously not allowed to move, so there's that sort of physical problem. Then you might have something like emotional harm, where you've got a wounded feeling, and that's very hard to gauge, because the things that may trigger you emotionally are going to be different to the things that trigger me emotionally. And there's the subjectivity problem, but again
you get people who are very psychologically and emotionally fragile.
Yes.
And you get people who are extremely robust. So again, it's subjective. It's difficult to quantify that harm.
We do have this interesting principle in law called the thin skull rule, which is that you take your victim as you find them.
Uh-huh.
So the idea is that if someone has a skull as thin as a piece of paper, and you throw a rock at them and it results in their death, and you intended to cause that harm, that you're then liable. So we do take into account some sense of victim vulnerability, and we place that risk on the perpetrator. But you also want to say, well, is there some sense in which someone is unreasonably sensitive? So there's cases with Jehovah's Witnesses who refuse blood transfusions. And so someone stabs a Jehovah's Witness and they start bleeding, and then they refuse to have a transfusion to save their lives. There's a question whether the attacker is liable for murder because this other person has this odd belief. And so we might think of that in the speech context as well, that I say something which I think is perfectly banal, and you are incredibly upset by it because of your personal history. And so we want to kind of keep that on the scales when we do the balancing act.
So there is still quite a lot, despite these very clear provisions that were made in the Constitution. And the Constitution is the supreme law of the land.
Mm.
Anything else that's brought after that must comply with it.
Yes.
But so, even in that, there's some interpretation.
So you're right. So there's this interpretive task. We've got to work out what all these words mean. We must understand them fairly. And part of that, the courts play a huge role in working out what does the Constitution mean. So facts get brought before a court, and the language gets tested in that process. I will say this, that there's an additional general clause in the Constitution that's not spoken about very often.
26 or something, right?
36. So 36 is the limitations analysis. And the idea is that all of these rights can be limited, provided that the limitation is justifiable in an open and democratic society. And then it provides a five-pronged test to work out whether the limitation is justifiable.
Okay. What are those? Because we want to cover all of it. I'm sorry if this is the minutiae of the whole
That's
thing.
That's exactly what we should be talking about.
Yeah. I think this is important. If South Africans are concerned about hate speech and free speech, as we pretend to be whenever there's a controversy, then we should know the facts. So you have the Constitution with its three very distinct provisions for what is not free speech.
Yes.
And then you have this Clause 36, the Limitations Clause. It says any of the rights in the Human Rights Bill can be in some way limited, provided it's in keeping with the open democratic society we wish to have, which we know was written by the fathers of our nation when they put the Constitution together. They give you this test of five things. Tell us what those are.
So the first thing we've got to do is we've got to determine the importance of the right. So the nature of the right is going to matter. So when you look at something like free speech, it's this fundamental right. The Constitutional Court has said that it's a right viewed by political philosophers as being essential, that other rights flow from it.
Mm-hmm.
That it plays an important role in a number of ways. So firstly, In the search for truth, it's important that we are able to freely express ideas, and that not only true ideas are expressed, but false ones, so that we can knock them down, so that we can sharpen our swords in this sort of quest for what's actually true. Because also, we're not always sure. You know, we're not infallible. So this sort of contest of ideas in the marketplace allows us to try and work out what's actually true.
Right.
The other thing that it does is that it helps us become truly autonomous. So if what you have to imbibe is the state propaganda, and you're never making any actual decisions for yourself, you can't really consider yourself a rational agent.
Yeah.
If you're having to expose yourself to these different kinds of ideas from different perspectives, you're doing up this internal weighing exercise. So it's important for dignity as well. So we often think about freedom and dignity being on opposing poles, and sometimes they are. So in defamation cases, you know, you've got your sort of interest in your reputation, and I've got my interest in free speech, and we have to strike this balance about what I can say, given your dignity interests. Here, the two support each other. That in order to be a dignified person, it's important that you're given the capacity to speak freely, so that you can actually...
Well, otherwise you're not really free, are you?
Not really free.
Yeah. If you want to know whether you're free or not, just learn about the things you're not allowed to say. Okay, so, I mean, on that first point, the right to free speech is very important.
Mm.
It's unlikely then that the Constitutional Court anyway will ever find that it was okay to limit that right to free speech. Very rare.
So well, let's look at the rest of the prongs, and we can talk about what the court's done in hate speech as well.
Right.
So the other thing is looking at what is the nature of this limitation that's proposed. So that it's got to be a law of general application that's doing the limiting. So something like the hate speech bill is such a law.
Okay.
And so we look at, well, how is it different to what the Constitution requires? How is it eating into our right?
Mm-hmm.
And you look at the nature of that limitation. And then you look at whether the purpose of that limitation is a good one and whether it actually achieves it through the limitation. So I'll give you an interesting example in the hate speech bill itself. So I've kind of described a little bit about what the Constitution says hate speech is, and then we look at the definition in the bill, and it's very different. So it describes hate speech as speech that's insulting, threatening, and abusive, that aims to draw people into contempt or ridicule them. We're talking about very different standard thresholds than violence and harm.
Yeah.
The bill does use that language, but it also allows for these much more watered-down things. So...
I mean, this could be a joke.
Yes. Well, ridicule is, of course, about, you know, poking fun at people.
Mm.
So it would have the effect of criminalizing certain jokes. So let's say you want to tell a joke about lawyers, right? So what do you call 100 lawyers at the bottom of the ocean? A good start. So
now, if you were a particularly sensitive lawyer, in terms of what's proposed in the hate speech bill, you could actually seek criminal charges to be brought against that joke and the person telling it.
Yes. So it's not even that...
a cartoon and you could find yourself in jail if they successfully prosecute you.
I'll give you a good example of a cartoon that would fall foul of the law.
Uh-huh.
So it's a cartoon depicting Donald Trump.
Yes.
He's got a Hitler mustache. He's got a swastika armband, and he says, "Register Muslims." Okay. So we look at this and we say, hold on. This cartoon is trying to critique this... this guy by comparing him to Hitler and saying he's a fascist, they want to, you know, debunk this dangerous idea of registering Muslims. But what the bill does, it says that if you insult someone in order to ridicule them on the grounds of, and then it lists not just the four grounds of the Constitution, but 17 grounds.
Including your job.
Yeah, occupation, that's where the lawyers come in.
If I mock you for being a plumber, that is also actionable.
Yes, sure. And in this case, the funny one is that it's about belief. So Donald Trump and his supporters believe that you ought to register Muslims or have a Muslim ban. Now, when you want to poke fun at Donald Trump for doing that, you've then committed the crime.
Mm.
So the problem with the legislation is that it's at odds with itself. If the purpose is to try and protect the weak and the vulnerable, but you deny them the ability to speak back, you know, you have this internal difficulty. And you know, one of the things that's the most powerful for the vulnerable is to be able to speak truth to power, and to, you know, to use the pen. You know, the satirists are often in a weak position.
It basically makes revolution impossible if it were applied in a utopian totalitarian way. The hate speech bill. Whoever wrote it must have had, perhaps they had good intentions. Let's imagine they did. Let's imagine their intention was noble and that they just wanted to stop people from hurting each other, their feelings and emotions and all the rest, something we can all agree with.
Sure.
But in practice, what it would do is it would prevent any different opinions from rising to the surface. It would prevent anyone from making jokes. It would prevent anyone from being able to stand up to power in any way.
It makes it very difficult. You know, given that occupation's list of ground, it makes it quite hard to make fun of politicians.
Yes.
And particular politicians. There's something of
who are scoundrels. I'll say that now, and if you prosecute me in 3 years' time, should this bill come to fruition, fine. But they're scoundrels. They're the worst people in society. They're parasites. They seek to have control. They're incapable of generating any income themselves. These are among the most scurrilous people that exist. And they want to protect themselves from the rest of us who are out there earning a living.
And so a speech like that could wind you up in jail for 3 years. And if you
right.
did it again, it would be 10 years. Now, here's something else that must be borne in mind. The bill bakes in prosecutorial discretion. So it says that the NDPP, Sean Abrahams, can decide whether to persist in a prosecution against someone that's committed the offense. So here's the problem.
So it's also capricious.
Yes. So you can sort of decide, well, this person who's not a member of the ruling party has said something that's a breach. Throw the book at them. But this person who is not a member of the ruling party, they've done the same thing, but we're not going to prosecute. So you have this
even,
arbitrary discretion.
Not even fair application.
No. So if you think about the rule of law is about everyone being treated equally under the law.
Right.
It's already being upended by having this room for discretion. Now, I've used the word ruling party for a reason, which is that governments that are in power often think that they will rule until Jesus comes back.
But that's this one not, has even said so.
Yes. But that's not how it goes. You know, if you look at the states, you now have a Republican after having a Democrat. And the problem is that the new regime inherits the laws of the old regime. Mm. And they can use those tools that were crafted by their former enemies against them.
Well, people are criticizing a lot of the things that Trump is doing in his first few weeks as president. Many of those executive powers are powers that were adopted under Democratic presidents. Most especially the last one, whom the Republicans loathed. But now, since those powers are held nice and tightly by the president, the executive, he's going to make full use of them. And they know exactly what they're dealing with because they were the ones who opposed that stuff during the Obama regime.
It's a concern. So
you make a rod for your own back.
Exactly. You know, I think legislators need to draft with what happens if I'm not in power? You know, what happens if the people in Parliament who I think are the most despicable come to power and they get to use this piece of legislation? How would I feel about that? You know, liberals generally have this disdain for government. We don't trust government. And I think that's important for those in government to think the same of each other. Because, you know, when you craft this weapon, it can be used to lop off your own head in time. So you've got to be careful. You want to sort of limit power so that it's used properly for the, you know, the right effective purposes, not capriciously.
You mentioned John Stuart Mill earlier.
Mm.
Now, is that the kind of classical liberalism that you like? Because that's an English Enlightenment liberalism, individual liberalism, as opposed to group liberalism, where, you know, it's applied to some groups more than in others. Do you know what I mean?
Well, what's interesting is, so that I'm interested in Mill's ideas because of the ideas being good. You know, it's sort of irrelevant to me that he's English. And I think this is also something that's...
No, but as a philosopher then.
Yeah, I think he's a great philosopher. But
your own philosophy.
Oh, sure.
Are you, because a lot of lawyers are concerned with the rights of an individual.
Yes. So there's this interesting...
And you mentioned you're suspicious of the state. This is why I'm asking.
Yeah. I think when we talk about group rights, we can run into difficult territory. You might think that the way to protect groups is to protect the individuals in that group, and that when we give the group itself a right, we can run into tricky territory to try and work out who's a member of this group, how does it persist over time. You know, I think one of the things that's quite interesting about our current discourse in South Africa is we assume some sort of continuity. So when we talk about you know, the evils of colonialism, and of white privilege, often what we're doing is sort of assuming this continuity, that we imagine that the person that perpetrated crimes in the past is the same person that's standing before you. So, you know, if there's an English person whose ancestors placed an Afrikaans person in a concentration camp, we should blame that past ancestor. They've done a horrible thing.
But the descendants shouldn't have to bear the sins of the father.
Exactly. This strange religious idea that we can...
Then a lot of black people in this country would say that that's young white people not taking responsibility for the privilege they've inherited as a result of their ancestors' nastiness.
So I suppose the question you've got to ask is, what privileges have you actually inherited? Are any of them unjustly accrued? If so, you should, shrug them off and say, well, I don't want this particular privilege. But there are others that you might say that are not unjustly accrued. I think, if you think about apartheid South Africa, you had true things like white privilege.
Yeah.
Built into the law.
Right.
In other words, in virtue of the
fact system was rigged for them.
Yes. State said, you're white and you get these legal privileges, you get these jobs reserved for you, you get privileged access to schools. We don't have a legislative framework that entrenches a white privilege. But you might think that there's some sort of social privileges that are there. But those can be dealt with, in a social way. People can just treat each other with respect and dignity and equally.
You could even break it down to the family. I mean, you might say that a certain family is more privileged than another family. Maybe the parents took more trouble and raised their children better in family A, and family B, quite apart from being poverty-stricken and not terribly nice people, took no interest in their children, and therefore their children are psychologically damaged. It's as big a deal to those children to complain about the privilege of family A as it might be for the whole of black South Africa to complain about the whole of white South Africa.
So this is it. I think when we start to lump each other into these broad categories like black and white, we forget about the granular detail, that all of us have a particular set of experiences, based on a number of particular things, like the way that you were raised, the advantages that you've had, the particular other identities that you hold. To sort of brandish people with the same brush seems rather dangerous.
Mm.
I'm also particularly concerned about racial language in a situation where Section 1 of our Constitution says South Africa is a nation founded on the value of non-racialism.
Mm.
It's an oft-forgotten provision in our Constitution.
Yeah, it's right up front, which means it's very important.
Yes.
Towards the tail end, it becomes less important.
Yeah, if you think about, towards the end of our Constitution, we're dealing with very procedural things, but to say in Section 1 it's a non-racial society, what we mean by that is that we don't allocate burdens and benefits on the grounds of someone's race. We don't judge the content of someone's character on the color of their skin. And we forget this entirely, when we sort of want to say that, you as a white person...
So if you're black first, land first...
Yes.
You're technically not operating within... You're doing anything illegal, but your provisions, up front and foremost, state that you are not in line with the general provisions of how this country was founded.
Yes, so you can at least say on a values level, they want something very different.
Yeah.
They don't care about non-racialism.
Similarly, if you have a white-only organization, I mean, it's patently not something that the people who wrote the Constitution would have been in favor of.
Yes, yeah. The idea is that we don't try and treat each other differently on the grounds of something as arbitrary as the color of our skin.
Right.
What's also interesting, so...
Even saying white monopoly capital might land you in that territory.
Yes. Well, you're at least trying to allocate blame, on this basis. I'm suspicious of race in general. So, and I think most people that cared about justice were suspicious of race during apartheid. That when you had pencil tests and you're trying to work out, what racial group someone fell into, there was this pretense of some sort of scientific agenda that we could really know this stuff, that we could count the drops of black blood
in someone.
It is. I like to say that we're all mixed race. If you kind of do a test on us, we all have mixed ancestry.
Mm-hmm.
We just present in different ways. The idea that, biologists don't believe in this notion of race. They say there is no necessary and sufficient set of criteria that can tell you whether someone belongs into a particular racial group. So if you think about people that have dark skin, you find them in all parts of the world. You find that you have people that are considered part of the black race that are albino. That are as white as this table.
Right.
So
if you're going to count the melanin, they fall outside of it. You can't tell me that they're not black people.
Yes. So we at least accept that this concept is a, socially constructed concept. And if that's the case,
then why do we make it so important?
Yes.
In the law, do they consider it to be important?
Well, we used to consider it very important in our law. If you think about whites only benches,
sure.
And segregated areas, group areas, that kind of stuff, we baked it into our system, and it was unjust then. And you might think that we're doing similar stuff now with affirmative action laws, that as much as we don't have a way to determine someone's race in our law anymore, we still allocate burdens and benefits on that basis. And there's something dangerous about entrenching race as an important criteria. I take the view that it's important to redress the wrongs of the past, but that you don't have to do so through a racial mechanism, that you can do so through a non-racial mechanism. And so what our Constitution says in Section 9, the Equality Clause, it talks about redress for previous disadvantaged individuals, which is a non-racial term. You can go and look at, did you as an individual suffer disadvantage? If so, that should be corrected. If you think about, imagine the two of us are running a race and you're running it in shackles, and halfway through the race, while I'm far ahead, someone says, oh, this is actually a little bit unfair, we should undo your shackles. And we do that. We can't just continue the race. You've clearly been disadvantaged by the fact that you've been shackled. We must, put you up to a level where you can compete fairly. As liberals, I care about, fair equality of opportunity.
But the problem is that your allegory of the race doesn't take into consideration that you can't turn back the clock. You can't cancel the whole race.
Yes.
You can't start again.
We must proceed.
And then it's difficult to, how many meters extra should you be given? How many meters should I be pulled back, for example?
So just because it's a difficult exercise doesn't mean we ought not to do it.
But
we must still do it in a way that's just.
But you're saying it's on an individual disadvantage basis.
Yes.
Which is important.
And I'll give you...
You can't assume these things.
So I'll give you a good example. People often say to me, but how could you implement a non-racial affirmative action system? And I say, we have one of the biggest non-racial redistribution policies in the world. Our social grants are not done on the basis of race.
Mm.
They're done on the basis of poverty levels.
Mm.
So you look at someone's individual circumstances, you see how needy they are, and you get a social grant on that basis. No one's coming around with a pencil or a Panatone sheet and working out whether you're dark enough or light enough to get the grant. We do this individual assessment, and we do it for, I think, 16 million people.
Mm-hmm.
So why not do that in other areas? Why not do that in an employment section? I think just because someone looks like a victim or looks like a perpetrator doesn't make them actually that. Treat them for who they really are.
Yeah. So you are a total individualist, which I like. And so is the law, then, in respect of our Constitution.
Yeah. So... There are interesting areas that I think are complicated. So we have cultural rights, for example, and rights to language in some ways. So you might think that these broader institutions are important. They're important to particular individuals.
Mm.
And so one way that you can protect them is by protecting individual rights.
Okay. You are the expert on this. I don't want us to get too bogged down in the details so that people get bored and fall asleep, even though you and I are clearly very interested in this. But I also don't want us to skirt past important stuff.
Mm.
So we've largely gone into Section 36. Based on all of that, and I don't expect you to now say what your opinion is on the constitutionality of the hate speech bill, but it is problematic.
So I think I'll tell you a bit about what will happen going forward. So the bill's been proposed. It was proposed under interesting conditions because it was a sort of knee-jerk reaction to a particular incident.
Mm.
The public is then given an opportunity to comment on it. So people can produce submissions. Individuals have done this. A lot of organizations have stepped forward. SciFact, the Helen Suzman Foundation, the Free Market Foundation have all produced submissions. Parliament will then consider those submissions. And at that point, they have an opportunity to decide whether to change the bill or not. If they don't, and the bill is passed in its current form, the constitutionality will be then tested by the courts.
So someone will have to take it to court.
Well, what you'll find is that some person will be prosecuted.
Mm.
So you, for example, will make a joke about parasitic politicians,
mm-hmm.
and someone who's offended will prosecute you.
Mm-hmm.
You'll then have to spend an enormous amount of money defending yourself. And in that process, you may decide to challenge the constitutionality of the law and say, it extends beyond what the Constitution requires, and it's not justified by the Limitations Clause. And then a court could decide whether the sections are constitutional or not constitutional. I will say that there's a famous case before the Constitutional Court where they had to look at other legislation that tried to go beyond the limitations in Section 16. And the court found that in that case, the prohibitions were too strong, that free speech was too important, and they were struck down for being unconstitutional.
Oh, so there's precedent already.
Yes.
Hmm. All right. A couple of other things, because it's rare that I have someone here who can speak in such an erudite fashion about so many things. Let's just talk quickly about America, because then it's also objective and you can't get into trouble. So let's talk about this Muslim ban. First of all, they're calling it a Muslim ban. 9 out of 10 Muslim countries that are not on the list, there's no problem with those people coming in. These are particularly countries which Barack Obama had a hand in bombing, and previous administrations have also been much looser about the liberties of people from those countries, let alone travel restrictions, which is what this is. Do you feel that this is going to be an area where Trump could get into some trouble as a?
Well, he already has. So, after the executive order was signed into law, there was utter chaos in the airports. People who'd been granted visa applications were told that even though the state had decided that they were safe to come in, that they were no longer entitled to come back.
Mm.
So you have people that had been, working at universities, raising families, and because they had Iranian or Syrian passports, that they now couldn't come back home, that they were separated. And so two states fought this in the court. So Washington State said, this is a problem for our state, because we're depriving our citizens of access to the wealth of other nations. We've got professors from Iran and Syria and from Yemen providing enormous value, and now they can't come back home, and this is a problem for us. And so they challenged the executive order, and they won in the initial court, in their state court. And so what Trump did was they brought an urgent stay, basically, to sort of block that court's order, so that the executive order could then come back. And they did this in the appeals court, the Ninth Circuit. And so there you had three judges looking at it, and they decided not to grant the stay to the government. And the primary reason that they had was this concern of being able to give people due process rights, so that it's important that people are evaluated fairly. And that the nature of the executive order was that it had immediate effect without any possibility for someone to produce counter reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And on that basis, the stay wasn't granted. Now, it's open to the government to go into the merits of whether the executive order is constitutional or not. One of the issues considered by the court was whether this does constitute a Muslim ban in the sense that it's specifically targeting people on the grounds of their religion. Now, the appeals court raised the issue, but felt it wasn't necessary to decide on that issue because there were other reasons why the stay needs to be granted. I think some of the arguments that were raised were looking at the context in which the order was signed. So Trump, when campaigning, specifically talked about a Muslim ban. You know, it's not a term that was invented by his opponents. It was invented mm-hmm. by him. And so you may think that there are certain laws that are neutral in their face that are nonetheless racially or religiously discriminatory.
Right.
So if you have a law that prohibits people with blue eyes from entering your state, it's likely to have disproportionate racial effect.
Mm.
There are people with blue eyes, with lots of different skin colors, but most of them tend to be pale. So most of those countries...
Most people from Syria are Muslims.
Yeah. Now, there's a second concern, which is that he specifically has a stay on refugees coming in from Syria. Now, I find this alarming given my personal history. So America blocked boats in the 30s coming from Nazi Germany. So you had Jews who were, being murdered in Europe, fleeing so that they could find refuge in other parts of the world, and they were sent back to die. And the same thing has happened to Syrian refugees. You've got people that are educated, that are looking for, another opportunity to sort of, lead a decent life, the pursuit of happiness, which is supposed to be promised by America, and they're refugees. So we're not talking about an ordinary immigration situation. We might think that states should decide who gets to come in, but refugees are granted special international status. You're talking about people that are fleeing, fleeing war zones, escaping genocides. We generally see that is something that goes beyond ordinary rights of states to say no. And so for Trump to send these people back to die is unconscionable.
And thankfully, the courts intercede, and they win.
So this is the separation of powers at play, and I think it's something that Trump finds difficult to deal with.
He's been the the executive, the judiciary and the legislature in the Trump organization.
Exactly.
Now suddenly he has his powers curtailed by these other organs.
And what's interesting is his reaction. So to say that, you know, well, when an incident happens, it'll be, you know, on the judges, you know, who've let these terrorists inside. You know, there's sort of a blackmail that's going on,
yeah.
Disrespect for the judiciary. You know, instead of saying, well, I accept that, you know, there's different levels of power, you know, and ultimately the Constitution is what matters, and I tried to pass legislation that was unconstitutional, and so be it if it wasn't. You know, instead there's this outright attack on another branch of government. And, you know, we think of the fourth arm of government, the press, and how he's, you know, run a campaign against the press, describing them as dishonest, as enemies of the people, as the opposition party. You know, he's trying to destroy the other check on his power. Very dangerous. The kind of thing that totalitarians like to do.
Yeah, you could also argue that he has been their victim for much of the time, and they're not doing themselves any favor by being hysterical and comparing him to Hitler some of the time. If both sides were a little more reasonable and could realize the benefits of having each other in the room, there might be some positive progression.
So I think you're right. There's this big concern about hysteria and hyperbole. I think one of the reasons why someone like Trump has come to power is because those on the left have acted in such an hysterical manner. You know, that when you...
Well, Hillary lit the powder keg and nobody put it out. If she'd won, that would have put it out.
I mean, it's...
But now there's this, you know, this build-up to, oh my God, he's literally Hitler. And suddenly he's in power, and suddenly he's your president, and suddenly he's making laws, and they can have real effect. And instead of it just being a manufactured election hysteria, now it's a manufactured real-life hysteria, and people aren't sure how to deal with this. And Hillary hasn't diffused it. She can't.
Yeah. So, I mean, it sort of reminds me a lot of tensions that you had in the States in the 60s, you know, that you had public protests, that you had this...
Around Vietnam and the civil rights movement or
exactly,
what?
Yeah. So I think it's a similar kind of mood.
What do you think about the issues of free speech in America? I mean, you must have a point of view about where the threats are coming from there. It's something we talk about often on this show.
So America is sort of always seen as the big guiders of free speech. You know, the limitations they have on free speech are very narrow there. But there's, at the same time, a huge clampdown on opportunities for people to express ideas, especially on American campuses. So you think about what happens to Molly Yiannopoulos at UC Berkeley.
Yeah.
You know, he says, I'm a provocateur. I'm going to say things that people are going to find offensive. I'm going to dress up in an Indian headdress.
Well, he's an objectionable troublemaker.
Yeah, you know, and he sort of, you know, part of his shtick is that he likes to poke fun. And so you might think that the way that you deal with that is you poke fun back at him, you interact with the guy, you provide counter dialogue. But what you find when you see Berkeley is that the campus gets shut down, buildings get torched, that there's this complete clampdown on the idea of having any contrary view being expressed, that it will not be tolerated.
These are the weapons being used to prevent him from coming, torching of... destruction of property, physical violence against people who do want to hear him, they're building a wall.
Yes.
They're building a Trump-style wall around their campus because it's their safe space or their home away from home. But his only weapon, so far, to my knowledge, is words.
Undoubtedly so.
And if that's the case, you know, even in criminal law, you can't use... an overmighty weapon against your assailant, or else you're guilty of a kind of crime yourself.
So I think the problem is that because people have tried to distort the meaning of words by saying, well, his presence is a violence, you know, and his language is violent,
right.
That we can then use other acts of violence in retaliation, like attacking him physically, beating him up, punching him, burning stuff down. It's fair, because what they've done is distort the meaning of the words.
And this brings us back to those provisions in the Constitution, where it comes to, you know, what actually is hate speech and what is hateful speech, and the fact that some people just view the idea of something nasty being said as bad as incitement to violence.
Yes.
Or propaganda for war.
And that's why it's important for us to draw the distinctions clearly.
So words do matter. Errors. So while someone like Milo will say, sticks and stones may break my bones, words will never harm me, actually the words matter for the application, the fair application of the law.
Yes. So we must look at the particular words and ask, well, was there a call to action? Is Milo calling for a genocide? Is he inciting imminent violence? You know, is he doing these dangerous things? And from what I've seen, I'm not very fond of a lot of what he says.
No.
But it doesn't seem to do anything that's actually dangerous. I mean, his tour is called the Dangerous Faggot Tour.
Mm.
You know, he sort of has this real sense of humor about himself. You know, he says that he has an affirmative action policy in the bedroom where he only sleeps with black men. He calls Trump daddy. You know, a lot of it is this kind of like performative comedy act, you know.
And I suppose the sensible thing to do is really just to consider him entertainment.
Yes.
Not necessarily everybody's cup of tea when it comes to entertainment, but certainly not the kind of person who's going to change the world or send us screaming into a totalitarian state.
Yeah, that, you know, seems to be very skeptical of authority figures generally. And so I think it's important, you know, let those guys have their forum to express their ideas and then fight back with words.
Well, what is the alternative? Should we shut down these kinds of free speech? I mean, what do they want on the left? What is their utopia consist of? These people, are we going to change their ideas by shutting them down?
So what worries me, this is a...
Or do they not care about changing ideas?
So I think they care about their particular agenda, and one way to do that is to act in a powerful manner.
But there isn't even an agenda, because transgender activists actually don't care about Black Lives Matter, and Black Lives Matter don't care about gay rights, and none of those three aforementioned give a damn about women in the Middle East, and even feminists don't care about what happens to a woman in a burqa in Afghanistan, but they're terrifically incensed when someone says that there isn't a glass ceiling in the corporate world. So they don't even have a combined agenda.
I think there's a difficulty in a consistent worldview. I think they have temporary allegiances. So you found in the 80s that feminists and those on the religious right formed this temporary alliance around pornography. That both of them were against it for different reasons.
Yeah.
And so you find the problem with these alliance partners is that they can start to corrupt your original idea. So feminists who've allied with Islamists now struggle to critique female genital mutilation because you're, you know, detracting from your alliance partner's agenda.
Mm.
So it's hard to be consistent and, you know, to have a true sense of what's going on. And an interesting idea for me is someone like Germaine Greer makes the comment that if a man decides to wear a dress and proclaim himself a woman, he's an imposter, you know, and she's skeptical of this idea that someone can be truly transgender.
She says it's a mental health issue.
Yeah.
Yeah. She goes so far as to say that those people are possibly mentally ill.
And she's
a respected feminist. I mean, really, she drove this agenda largely on her own, took huge amounts of criticism at a time where feminism was considered outrageous to most men.
Yes, sure. Yeah, so you're talking about someone who is at the forefront of her movement, is now banned from certain campuses on the grounds that she's transphobic. But then you have to have a look at a local issue. So you've got Kazi Malungu, who says that she's transracial.
Mm.
And you have exactly the same idea, that the idea that a white person can don themselves in a black identity, it's cultural appropriation, that they're an imposter.
And huge uproar.
Huge
from people who think that this is an unacceptable point of view.
Maybe some people think that she's mentally deluded, but you have this inconsistency that, you know, those in the same camp are happy to believe in transgenderism but not transracialism, which is interesting.
Because the one is biologically a lot more demonstrable than the other.
Yeah, we at least think that, you know, sex has some biological basis, even if it does occur on a spectrum that you've got intersex people
sure.
in between.
Sure.
And that
even where gender is a little bit blurry, sex is fairly clearly defined.
And with race, if we think that there's nothing underlying going on a biological level, it makes a lot of sense that someone could identify as transracial.
Yeah, makes more sense than transgenderism in some way.
Sure, yeah.
Well, what controversial anthill have you kicked over now? What will they be calling you and I? And does this fall into the hate speech bill's provisions? Would we be in trouble for this?
Quite possibly. So the bill does specifically mention intersex and transgenderism. If our words are interpreted as being insulting or ridiculing to those classes of people, we could be held liable.
Would you say that women-only gyms or places that only cater to straight weddings should be allowed to do this?
So this is this interesting clash of rights that we have. So our constitution says that you have a freedom of association, but also you have this right to not be discriminated against by private parties. So if we think about a gym like Curves, right?
Mm-hmm.
Curves is an international gym, and they
don't have men.
Yeah, no men, women only. And the argument is that women should have a space that's private, that's their own, where they're not being ogled at by men, and this should be reserved for them. And that there are plenty of other gyms around the world.
Mm.
If you want to go to a co-ed gym, there are plenty of other options.
Great.
You're not depriving anyone of an option.
I don't mind if the attractive women come to the co-ed gyms and the unattractive ones go to Curves. And I don't care if that's also going to fall me into or put me into the category of transgressors of the new hate speech bill. But yes, how do you interpret this legally?
So I think our intuition is that Curves should have the right to be a women's only gym.
Hmm.
Where we get uncomfortable is when you have institutions that are more vital. So let's say we had whites-only courts.
Hmm.
We might think that this is a public institution. It's important for everyone to have equal access to justice, and that there's only one court system, really. So if you've got a monopoly on the institution, it's important that it's open to all. So I think what matters is if you're the only game in town. So if you're, if there is only one place where people can do this thing and you decide to exclude people on an arbitrary basis, then it seems like you've intruded too far.
Because the market will surely look after itself here. If you open up a restaurant on a block of four restaurants, and at your restaurant you say, I'm only having white people in.
Yes.
I mean, there will be outrage and offense and protest, but effectively your money talks, and that business will run out of customers faster than the other three who catered to everybody.
I would think so. So I think it's likely that what you'll have is your white-only people policy will lead to no people. No one will want to go to your restaurant,
no.
Which means the market decides.
Because it's not as if white people will want to be seen in a whites-only restaurant anyway.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, sensible ones. There are a lot of stupid white people who might.
And you might think the same about a wedding venue that says, we don't do gay marriages. So when friends of mine were shopping around for venues, one of them, you know, took this declaration, and they're a straight couple, and they said, well, then we're not going to give you our business. You know, that if you want to be bigoted, then don't. We're not going to give you our money. And so the marketplace decides.
Have the government climb in, usually a bad thing.
I would think that there are certain exceptions where we go, because this is an industry controlled by so few, that really it's a monopoly and it's depriving people of access to an important commodity for an arbitrary basis, then I think you can climb in. But generally when we're talking about things like restaurants and gyms, I think be free to be biggest and you'll be punished by the marketplace.
I'm afraid we're out of time. We could talk all day. This stuff is fascinating, and you're clearly educated along many lines of conversation that have to do with all of these things, hate speech, free speech. I think we're only just getting to grips with it as a country in terms of the ordinary populace here. For you, it must be frustrating sometimes to hear how little people know about it, but how much they pretend to care about it.
I see it as an opportunity. You know, it's lawyers are often, we're stuck in our ivory towers, and I think what we need to be doing is doing this translative work.
Mm.
Explain to people what's actually meant by the Constitution, inspiring people to read it, to engage. You know, we're living in a unique era now where people care about what's happening in our courts. You know, people watch the Pistorius trial, they watch Mogoeng delivering judgments. It's this wonderful time for lawyers and for the law, and I just hope that more people spend more time thinking about the issues and grappling with them and debating them.
Well, thank you very much, Mark Oppenheimer, and we hope to hear more about your cases that you have ongoing as well. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. CliffCentral.com.